This is an iHeart podcast.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations. Thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
New York City just nominated a communist. We'll talk about that and why that kind of thing happened. Senator Ron Johnson is here to update us on the budget. Josh Hammer, what happened when he was in Israel? All that and more coming up on I'm Right. Okay, New York City. Let's go ahead and knock this out right off the bat. New York City, last night, if you were paying attention, which most people were, we found out this Mamdani guy won the Democrat nomination to be the next mayor of New York City. Now, let me pause before we get into him and how this kind of thing happens. And let me just explain something we've talked about before. You may not care for New York City. Maybe you've never been. Maybe you've been and you've hated it. Maybe you hate all cities. All those things are totally understandable. Completely understandable. I'm not trying to talk you out of that. But at least understand this. America's cities and America's rural area, they're all part of America. And New York City in particular is our most important city when it comes to finances. There's all kinds of, there's just, for a lot of reasons, New York City is extremely important. So maybe you're watching me right now from rural Arkansas. I'm not suggesting you go to New York City. You might hate it. But understand that New York City matters because it's on our billboard, meaning internationally, people will look at the things that happen in New York City and we will take that as, or they will take that as, well, that's what America's like. For instance, London. How often do you see these reports out of London? Do you see London on social media? How often have we brought up things? What's going on over there in London? But we have these gangs. We have the... You take that as being the UK, don't you? Of course you do. It's human nature. So do I. If New York City implodes more than it already is, it's going to make the entire country look bad. And I care about that a great deal. So now let's talk about this freak who may very well be the next mayor.
The mayor will use their power to reject Donald Trump's fascism. To stop mass ICE agents from deporting our neighbors. And to govern our city as a model for the Democratic Party.
Yeah. He has many public statements, crazy public statements. Public statements destroying the NYPD. This is a man who's talked about packing the subway full of homeless people. Look, if he's mayor, it's going to be very, very bad. How does this happen? Why does this happen? Well, there is a coalition that we are fighting against as a nation right now. And because of the steps the Democrat Party has taken over the decades, we will have to fight against this coalition for a very long time. This coalition is majorly powerful. And here's what the coalition is. There are the upper crust, highly college-educated elites, college-educated white people for the most part. They are bred with American hatred. It is engraved in them. The longer you spend on a college campus, for the most part, the more communist you are going to be. So these people have been indoctrinated firmly in the fact that this country sucks. And that's why everybody should get to come here and just pillage the place, because this evil country deserves that kind of a thing. That's one part of the coalition. The other part of the coalition is the disloyal foreigner. The disloyal foreigner that Democrats and Republicans have brought in by the million over the decades. Why would Democrats bring in 20 million new foreigners in just 4 years under Joe Biden? And that's not even talking about the tens of millions they brought in beforehand, just the 20 million under Joe Biden. Why are they all about it? Why are they now protecting these people from deportation? Well, you just watched what happened in New York City. Democrats understand that the bread and butter American, the red, white, and blue American, wherever he may be, New York City or Montana or anywhere else, is going to reject their disgusting, despicable communism, and he's going to reject their goal of burning down the country. But the foreigner, he's fine with it. Hand him a welfare check. Hand him a little bit of power. Hand him a little bit of this. Bring in as many of those people as possible. Buy them off with a $500 Visa card. And you haven't just imported foreigners. You've imported a voting army that will march to the polls and put the communists in power forever. That is why they love immigration. By the way, illegal and legal. Mass legal immigration is just as bad as mass illegal immigration. By the way, in case you're wondering, Jesse, has he lost his mind? Is he going too far? Here's one of the ads the guy ran.
बदलने के लिए लड़ रहा हूँ. Rent freeze, free buses, universal child care और सस्ती groceries के जरिए. पर आपको एक सवाल पूछना चाहता हूँ. तुमने कभी किसी को वोट किया?
Why do you think that is? This comes back to a conversation you and I've had so many times before. Maybe this guy, as much as it pains me to say it, maybe he now does accurately represent what New York City is. Just like Ilhan Omar, which we've discussed many times before, Rashida Tlaib, these types. We get mad when they say these horrible anti-American things and we say we should kick them out of Congress. Why? They are representatives. And they accurately represent their area. The problem is not the specific commie. The problem is the demographics of the country have radically changed. We have changed our own people, destroying their minds in college. And we've brought in a lot of others. And this guy, if elected, can you imagine the things he'll do with his power? He's talking about arresting foreign leaders if they come to town.
And Mayor Mamdani, would you welcome Prime Minister Netanyahu to New York City for the for whatever he comes for, given the U.S. is not a signatory to the ICC, so he can travel to the U.S., unlike a lot of other countries. Would a Mayor Mamdani welcome Benjamin Netanyahu to the city?
No. As mayor, New York City would arrest Benjamin Netanyahu. This is a city that our values are in line with international law. It's time that our actions are also.
How could they do that? How could they elect this man? Maybe that's what New York City is now. We don't like to accept these things. And it pains me because I love the place. Maybe he is a very accurate representation of what New York City has become, as painful as that may be. And look, when you think about New York City, I bet you money the NYPD comes to your mind. I bet you it's one of the top five things that pop in your mind when you think about New York City, especially after 9/11, all the heroism. But the NYPD, the largest, most powerful, highly trained police force on the planet. Well, surely New Yorkers love the NYPD, right? I don't know. The new Democrat nominee said this about them.
Are you for defunding the police? Are you for a serious reform that people can see on the ground?
I am in favor of defunding the police.
We don't like the accurate representations we see of certain areas of our country, but that doesn't change the fact they're accurate representations. If I look in the mirror and I'm cupcaking over my boxer shorts, I may not like the fact that I've gotten fat, but it's not the mirror that's the problem. The mirror is accurately reflecting what I have become. I know that's sad. I know that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Talk to a New York City expert about this in just a moment. Before we do that, let me talk to you about your cell phone. you need a new mobile provider because the mobile provider you currently have is garbage. Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, they charge you way too much because they put a store on every single street corner, which you have to pay for. And these companies take your money, and they themselves have contributed to the poisoning of American culture. Switch to Pure Talk. My bill got cut in half when I switched to Pure Talk. Pure Talk is so American, they hire Americans. Speaking of foreigners, when you get a hold of somebody at Pure Talk, it'll be an American who speaks English, not beep beep at a call center somewhere. Hello, can I help you? No, not at Pure Talk. Switch. It takes 10 minutes. Keep your phone number. If you want a new phone, they have that too. Switch to the patriotic cell phone company. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
Grocery prices are out of control. The cost of eggs and milk has skyrocketed. Some stores are even using dynamic pricing, jacking up the cost over the course of a day, depending on what they can get away with. It doesn't need to be this way. I'm Zahran Mamdani, and as mayor, I will create a network of city-owned grocery stores. It's like a public option for produce. We will redirect city funds from corporate supermarkets to city-owned grocery stores, whose mission is lower prices, not price gouging. These stores will operate without a profit motive or having to pay property taxes or rent, and will pass on those savings to you.
Great. That guy's probably going to be the next mayor of New York City. Jeez. Joining me now, Caroline Downey, senior fellow, Independent Women's Forum. Okay, Caroline, I love New York City. Unlike a lot of my conservative friends, I just adore the freaking place. And it makes me sick to my stomach that this guy might be the mayor. Is he going to be the mayor, or is Eric Adams, does he have a shot at what?
Well, Jesse, I'm a New York City resident, and my heart hurts for this city because it's amazing to me that this guy even got this far. It was shocking to see the ranked choice results roll in last night. Clearly, the system does elevate radical candidates, even though many said, oh, actually gives a voice to moderates. That did not happen last night. But look, I think we have to think about the general election. Like you said, there are other boroughs besides Manhattan. Staten Island, for instance, has a lot of Republicans. There's a lot of independents that still haven't made their voices heard. And I'm not so sure that Mamdani will win the day ultimately. I think we're going to see a lot of momentum fueled into Eric Adams' campaign. Now that he's an independent, he's a former cop. So I think he's going to have a lot of sway with the law enforcement community. That's the backbone of this city, the NYPD and other first responders. And I mean, you know, I think we got to see Cuomo or Curtis Sliwa on the Republican side basically back one or the other, because we can't have a situation where one is cannibalizing the other among voters. And then, you know, there's no alternative to Mamdani, and Mamdani ends up winning by default. But I don't think it's over yet. I'm seeing a lot of murmurs on the ground from Gen Z conservatives like myself in Manhattan that are saying, we're going to campaign for Eric Adams. We're all in for Eric Adams because he's not perfect. He's filled with scandals, his reputation, that is, just like Cuomo was. You know, I mean, it wasn't exactly killing nursing home patients, but it was allegedly taking bribes, and he's a party boy. You know, he likes to live it up in the clubs in the middle of a Tuesday, you know, at like 5 o'clock. But he also is more of a moderate, and he actually has governed, I would say, pretty well over the last year. I think we're pretty happy with Eric Adams' leadership. And I think now he's really got to step it up.
Yeah, honestly, I think I'm going to have Eric Adams on my show at this point in time just to try to save New York. Although it is a little weird at that age being in a club. I'm 43. I would rather die than go into a club. Anyway, so Can you explain to me the Cuomo factor? Because from the outside looking in, I'm not a New Yorker, even though I go all the time. I just assumed with his name ID and thus the Cuomo name ID period in New York and the money behind him, I kind of just assumed he was going to be the next mayor of New York City. And he couldn't beat this fruitcake commie from Uganda? Why?
You know, I think I felt the same thing as you. The Cuomo dynasty is very strong. It carries a lot of weight. The patriarch of the Cuomo family is obviously Mario, whose name is on the bridge that replaced the tap and Z. I mean, this family is very well connected. And I would argue that they really love this city, that because they have so many generations of political leadership in this city, they're very much devoted to its cause, even if they sometimes have progressive, not so great ideas. But Mamdani is very green. I mean, he hasn't been here that long, at least as a citizen. He might have gone to, I think it was Bronx High School, but he was born in Uganda. And let's just zoom out here. Regardless of how long he's been a native of Manhattan or hasn't been, his ideas fly in the face of everything that is important to this city and to this country. He has such a hostility, not only civilization, he is fundamentally at odds with New York City, which has been filled with these Gen Z transplants who are subsidized by their parents, who pay their rent. They really haven't worked hard like the blue collar working class of New York City has to build this city up. And you mentioned, so with the Cuomo factor, I think what was most interesting about the results breakdown is that those who made, I believe, under $50,000 in income supported Cuomo. So the working class, the blue collar, those Democrats supported Cuomo. The middle to upper class, those who are considered more wealthier, the college educated, they all voted for Mamdani. So much for the socialist candidate that is supposed to be representing the poor and, you know, liberating the proletariat. The proletariat does not want Mamdani because they're not stupid. They know that rent control has been tried many times before in New York City and it always fails. It always punishes landlords and leads to their buildings to fall into disrepair. And you can apply that principle to every single issue across the board. The rich elite that are Democrats voted for Mamdani. And as soon as the policies they voted for are actually implemented or actually imposed, they're going to realize how much they suck and they're going to evacuate. They're going to send their kids to private schools. They're going to go to the suburbs. They're going to go to Florida. And then who's going to be left in Manhattan? The poor people who didn't vote for this. And they don't have the mobility to get out just as much as the rich people do.
Caroline, can you explain these elite of New York? Is this when you vote for, let's say you're one of these snooty college-educated rich New Yorkers, and you go vote for this nutball communist, do you do so just so you can brag to your friends about it at parties? Because I've known Democrats like this in big cities. They act like the most left. They act left of Mao, and it's almost like they can brag about it at parties. It becomes almost a medal they wear on their chest that, hey, look at this crazy guy I supported. Is there some of that there?
I've seen this in the wild. There's a lot of flexing and virtue signaling and a holier than thou mm-hmm. mentality, I think, among older, frankly, boomer, college educated elites in Manhattan. And they've been very insulated. They've lived here for many years. And that's not to say that they're any less of New Yorkers, but they are in such a bubble that they kind of forget that there's a larger country, that there's other, you know, interests to be represented. And I think it comes fundamentally from a place of guilt, self-flagellation, which is we somehow have something to repent for as white upper-class Americans. And so we're going to elect a guy who is an avowed communist, who's a member of the Socialist Party. And then, of course, as part of that identity politics framework that they're all bought into, they think, you know, Israel needs to be disciplined and Mamdani is a Hamasnik. He's like if you took any random agitator on a Columbia protest encampment and made him mayor. That's basically who Zohran Mamdani is. And I just think the older generations of Democratic New Yorkers, they think, again, like you said, it gives them brownie points, like woke brownie points with their friends. friends. We saw Cynthia Nixon is just one example of the celebrities who stumped for Mamdani and I believe also did TikToks with Mamdani. She was in the famous New York show Sex and the City, right? And that was an iconic show, an iconic cultural, you know, you could argue masterpiece of the 90s. But she's so disconnected from the actual problems of New York City. I mean, a lot of these people, you know, I don't even think they know how socialism starts. I mean, or how communism starts. Democratic socialism is basically communism on training wheels, but I don't think they really know that. I think they just believe that it's going to make everything more equitable. It's going to give them bragging rights with their friends. But once it's actually implemented, we're going to see a lot of suffering. We're going to see a lot of not only inequities, but a lot of distortions in the market. We're already seeing capital flight, investment, and financial firms flee, probably for the winter Wall Street of Florida. We're going to see another asset price boom. Ron DeSantis can't wait. But, there's just going to be a brain drain of, I think, opportunity and innovation out of New York. And that trickles down to the small businesses. And like I said, the working class people who are going to face the consequences, but the rich won't.
Caroline, is there a larger Muslim demographic in New York City than people realize? I know New York City has always had a million different demographics, right? Italians and Chinese and Jews, and that everybody knows the history of New York City. It's long, but is there an Islamic aspect to this as well, where that population in New York has grown larger and therefore candidates like that are going to have an easier time getting elected?
Well, look, New York City is very diverse. It's the melting pot. That's supposed to be the claim to fame. But I think at some point it became a hotbed of the border crisis. Like, we know that that's true with at least Hispanic and Central American migrants flooding into the city, overwhelming the facilities. But I think in tandem with that, you know, I do think that there's been an increase in other kinds of migrants who have come to that part of you know, Manhattan. I mean, Mamdani, you know, like I said, he was raised in Uganda, or he was born in Uganda. He had his early childhood there, and then he came over here. But I think the biggest turning point in his young intellectual career and then political career probably was when he went to Bowdoin College in Maine, which is your classic, very progressive liberal arts school. Once again, very insulated, you know, just filled with Marxist professors. Like, just pick a random liberal arts school in America, especially in the Northeast, especially in New England, and you're gonna get an activist at the end of that. But I think for him, it was probably written in stone that he was going to be a radical democratic upstart. It's just very unfortunate that he made it this far. And it, like, frankly, if it wasn't for the ranked choice voting system, I'm not so sure he would have. But that's a real disappointment for New York City.
No doubt. Caroline, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Ugh, breaks my heart. I'm still going to sleep well tonight. I mean, not because of New York City, but because of Dream Powder from Beam. I'm going to have a cup of hot chocolate before bed, and I'm going to sleep like a little bitty baby. That's what Dream Powder does. It puts you to sleep naturally. I know there are so many things that will put you to sleep. There are. Your doctor will write you a prescription. You can go pick up something in the pharmacy, the gas station. How many things will put you to sleep and have you waking up not groggy? Because the sleep was natural. Dream Powder has those things you see on the screen in it. It's a cup of hot chocolate. You'd never know there were other things in it. It's delicious, but sip on a cup of hot chocolate before bed, sleep like a little bitty baby, wake up feeling great every single day. Once you get a bag of Dream Powder in your house, you'll always have one. Always. Up to 40% off at shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
All right, I know everybody's had their eyes focused all over the world and all over the country. We're worried about a dirty commie being elected in New York. There are bombs being dropped in Iran, but we have a domestic problem that, frankly, is probably bigger than all those things, and that's our spending, our debt, and we still have a big, beautiful bill, maybe? I don't know. How ugly is the beautiful bill? Let's ask the senator about it. Joining me now, Senator Ron Johnson of the great state of Wisconsin. Senator, I understand you just had a meeting at the White House about all this. How'd that go?
It went well, cordial. I have to lay out the problem we have here is the Democrats left us such an enormous mess, or actually messes. The border has to be cleaned up, wars, a $1.9 trillion average deficit over the last 4 years, when prior to the pandemic, the average deficit was $660 billion, about a third less. So these are not easy issues to deal with. So whether it's the Speaker, whether it's Majority Leader Thune, whether it's President Trump, we all want to rein in spending. It's how do we do it? Unfortunately, we've got big spenders in our party. We've got people demanding, higher SALT deductions. And again, it's a difficult thing to do. What my role has been is I've been just trying to make everybody focus on how do you solve a problem. First step, admit you have one. I think most people admit we have one. But the second important step is properly define it. And, I think one of the problems I have with congressional leadership is they say, well, the only numbers that count are 218 and 50. Well, if that's all you're worried about, you end up the lowest common denominator and you end up with a bill that just doesn't meet the moment. And that's kind of what we have right now. It is true. It's historic deficit reduction or spending reduction, not deficit, spending reduction. The problem is it's historic by an order of magnitude, the spending increase. We had more than $2 trillion increased spending in just 1 year. We're not even going to cut $2 trillion over 10 years. So I appreciate the work the House has done, but it just doesn't meet the moment.
Senator, can you help me understand what exactly people are protecting in the bill that makes these deficits still so bad? I'm not even going to ask you, obviously, to name names on who's protecting what, but clearly people are protecting ridiculous spending items. This can't all be SALT deduction stuff, can it? What are people protecting that people like you want to stop?
I just think they went about it the wrong way. They started over $7 trillion and then suffered death by 1,000 cuts. And they didn't do what I suggested. This is to pat myself on the back, but I went back and I suggested three pre-pandemic level spending options. Clinton in 1998, Obama 2014, Trump 2019. They'll use those actual outlays, increase them by population growth, inflation, and you start there. You leave Social Security, Medicare, and interest alone, spend what you need to spend for 2025, but all of the outlays plus up by that control, population growth and inflation. If you do that, your baseline budget would be somewhere between $5.5 and $6.5 trillion. Now, I've been beating this drum, beating my head against the wall now since January 1st when I first published my Wall Street Journal article. Unfortunately, people just blow it off. I don't know if it's just too many lines, too much work, or just... I think it's more just stuck in the old ways. Identify a couple programs, tweak them, get a CBO score, pull a number out of the air, $1.5 trillion. Again, that was just pulled out of the air. It bears no relationship to anything. It's not in any context. It's not half of the what we need to do. It just sounds like a big number, and it's completely inadequate. So, again, coming from the business world, I keep saying this would be easy. I would go to my managers and say, hey, guys, I said you could increase your budgets based on inflation and the number of customers you served. You're 40% over that. What's wrong with you? Get back in line or you're fired. That'd be about a five-minute conversation. I think most responsible business managers, A, wouldn't have increased their budgets at 23 or 40, or in comparison to the Clinton budgets, like 90% over what he spent, fully inflated. But you dial them back in. But it's not that easy here in government, unfortunately.
Okay, I understand the president is pushing to have a bill passed by July 4th, by Independence Day. Now, July 4th cometh, and that right soon. And to hear you talk, it doesn't sound like we're about to have a bill. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. And listen, I don't mind the pressure being applied to us because now we're finally starting to have the conversations. I mean, the committees, they've been working their tail off. Listen, I really appreciate all the work that Chairman Crapo's done of Senate Finance. He's been involving us in these meetings. But this is complex and it's hard. So now it's concentrating everybody's efforts. So now we're starting to have some pretty interesting discussions. I mean, I just came from lunch and, you know, there's good back and forth, which is what you need. These are difficult issues. Different states have different requirements. Different provisions affect different states differently. These are senators from those states. They represent their people. They represent their legislators. So this isn't easy. So what I certainly don't want is I don't want this bill. I have no problem with leadership and the chairman of the House, you know, sending us the draft. But now we need to take a look at things. And you know, what I proposed is, you know, and yeah, I'll show you right here. This is my line by line bullet point of the different elements, different provisions of the bill with their scores. If it's red, that means it's adding to the deficit. If it's black, it's reducing the deficit. There's generally more red on here than black. But what we ought to do as a conference is lock ourselves in a room, go line by line, element by element, score by score, and based on the definition of the problem, the fact that Biden on average incurred $1.9 trillion deficits per year. Right now, the CBO score of the OBB, the baseline is somewhere between 21 and 24 trillion over 10 years. In other words, $2.1 to $2.4 trillion. We got to do better than that. So based on that reality, you know, do we really need to cut that tax? Do we really need to offer that tax credit? Do we really need to spend that amount of money on that priority? That's the kind of work we ought to do. Again, you rush this thing, we won't do that work. And the last thing I want is for Republicans to take the Nancy Pelosi approach and say, well, we've got to pass this thing before we know what's in it. We need to thoroughly know what's in it. I'd like to, whatever the final text is, do an AI scrub. And the question I'd ask the AI is there anything in here that'd be just perfect, for example, a Tom Coburn waste book? If it is, we better take it out. Let's not be embarrassed by that.
No doubt. All right, let's shift gears off this horribly depressing topic, Senator. And I want to talk about something that's somehow actually more horrific. We now know, according to Kash Patel, that not only did China get involved in 2020's election in some way, fake driver's licenses and whatnot, that actually isn't even the most outrageous part. The most outrageous part is the Federal Bureau of Investigation covered that up. Now, Senator, for me, that means the Federal Bureau of Investigation should end completely. When the Secret State Police Agency does something like that, the entire agency should be shut down. But I'm not a naive human being. What can we do from here? Who's going to prison?
So let me describe the problem we've had here. Pam Bondi gets into the Attorney General's office there, Department of Justice, and they let go a lot of attorneys. They just couldn't trust them. They were obviously partisans. They're having a really difficult time replacing those individuals. One of the big reasons is, for example, we've got a wonderful person, Judge Troupas from Wisconsin, represented Trump for 30 days during the recount. Everything is above board. The Wisconsin Attorney General said what he did was fine in terms of the alternate slate of electors. Now he's spent over $1 million just defending himself against that same Attorney General in Wisconsin who's using lawfare against the judge simply for representing Trump. So they make examples of people like President Trump. They make examples of Judge Troupas for just simply representing a client. Just happens to be now the President of the United States. It's like they would never do that to somebody who represented a, you know, triple rapist murderer. But boy, if you represented Trump, they're going to destroy you. They're going to destroy your finances. They're going to destroy your career. So it's a real problem now for the Department of Justice to hire people to replace the ones. And look, I'm hearing there's a couple hundred people. That's a lot of manpower that you'd like working with you to uncover this abuse, to prosecute crime, but they don't have it. So listen, there's a real challenge. When a Republican administration comes into these partisan agencies, it's almost impossible to gain control of them. And you only got 4 years. They just wait you out. So listen, this is a real challenge. I am not criticizing Cash Patel or Pam or President Trump. This is just maybe an insurmountable task. So we have high expectations, but understand the deep state is powerful. It is deep. It's highly partisan and not in our favor.
What do they serve for lunch at the White House, Senator? Are we talking salads, burgers, steaks? What do they serve for lunch at the White House? Are we talking salads, steaks? Please tell me it was something. Smash burgers? Tell me it was something decent. The White House.
I don't know. I haven't eaten there for many, many years.
Oh, it's too bad. I'm dying to know. Senator, thank you. I appreciate it. All right. Josh Hammer was there in Israel in a bomb shelter a couple days ago. Let's talk to him next.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
Well, like we said, foreign policy is very complicated. Combat is very complicated. As I've mentioned a million times, in war, the first casualty is the truth. That's an old, old, old saying. And last week was wild. I mean, shoot, this week has been wild. Israel, Iran, America. What's the reality of it? It's hard to wade through everything, but one of the best ways to do that is talk to somebody who was actually there in some form or fashion. And Josh Hammer was. Of course, you know Josh Hammer. Joining me now, my buddy Josh Hammer, author of the book Israel and Civilization. Excuse me. Okay, Josh, the floor is yours. What happened last week?
Well, Jesse, I was there. My young family was there. My wife, our 6-month-old baby, and I, we were there when the war started. We were there for purely personal reasons, actually, for my wife's cousin's wedding, and we had a birthday party. I had a book event, but personal stuff. And on the fourth or fifth night we were there, I suppose it was, the sirens went off at 3 a.m. and the rest has been history. So for a few days we were running in and out of bomb shelters, and the thing to bear in mind, Jesse, is that it's usually there'll be an advance warning on your cell phone, like a loud siren noise will go off to say be near a bomb shelter. Not always, sometimes. But when the sirens in your local vicinity in the town actually go off, you have 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes to drop whatever the heck it is you're doing and run for your life to the safe room in the house, the bomb shelter. So you can imagine how this was starting to wear on us. Again, our 6-month-old baby was there. This is no joke, right? So the fourth night that we were there after the war started, I got reports of a neighboring town. We were staying in the Tel Aviv suburbs, a neighboring town. One of the missiles evaded the air defense and had a direct hit on the bomb shelter, and two people in the bomb shelter actually tragically died. So they did everything they could, and the bomb shelter did not protect them. So I said, that's it. We're getting the heck out of here. I did a little research. I live in Florida, as you know. I came across a program that Governor Ron DeSantis had partnered with to get Americans out. I got in touch with an amazing Florida state senator named Jay Collins, who was on the ground in Israel and Jordan getting Americans out. So it was a 3.5-day journey. Went from Israel to the Jordanian border up to Amman, the capital of Jordan, then to Cyprus, then to Tampa, where Governor DeSantis met us there. He actually asked me to join him at a press conference there at the airport last Friday. And then we got back to South Florida. So it was quite an ordeal, to put it mildly, there. And I saw some things that I don't necessarily particularly care to see again. I saw one factory that took a direct hit from an Iranian ballistic missile. It was on fire with billowing black smoke, the likes of which, you know, that's an image that you will not forget for a long time. I mean, Israel had become an active war zone, right? The IDF Mossad did a lot of amazing stuff in those first days of the war inside of Iran, but Israel itself had become a war zone, and it was time to get our family out. So thank God we're home safely, and I'm really happy to be here talking to you, Jesse.
Okay, One, I'm glad you're safe, my brother. Two, that is a story that is going to be told in your family for quite some time. So that's at least something. I need you to describe for me, though, I'm going to ask some details because people are curious. The bomb shelters, are they in people's homes? Are they large? Are they small? How many people go to these bomb shelters? Because this is a world, I ask it, Josh, I mean, you lived it, but this is a world we can't understand here in America. Sure. And I want you to lay it out for us.
Yeah, sure. No, great question. So the first thing to bear in mind, Jesse, is that most of the new construction in Israel, to be clear, the old buildings that existed 40, 50 years ago, they weren't built with bomb shelters. It wasn't really a thing. So maybe they were able to kind of add it on after the fact there. But the newer buildings typically have one room of the house that is extra fortified. I mean, extra layers of concrete there. You know, if you knock on the wall, you will essentially notice the difference between that room and the other rooms there. So we were staying primarily at a family friend's house in the broader Tel Aviv suburbs. And one of the bedrooms on the ground floor in the basement was the safe room. So that is where we evacuated. But a couple Sundays ago, we were at a neighboring town where my wife's grandmother lives. She lives in one of these older buildings, and they had to turn a large common area room on the ground floor of the apartment building into the safe room. And there's a lot of elderly people there. So, for instance, my wife's grandma's in a wheelchair. I mean, think about that. That's really logistically difficult to get an old woman in a wheelchair from the third floor down to the safe room with the sirens. It's really awful, honestly. It's frankly an awful reality. The final thing that I think is worth noting about this is these bomb shelters were typically built, and this is another thing that I think the American media has not really covered. These bomb shelters were built with these Hamas-fired rockets and mortars in mind. They were not necessarily built with Iranian hypersonic ballistic missiles flying 2,000 miles in mind. That is an apples to oranges comparison. These two things are simply not the same thing. So that is why there have been Israeli casualties, is that the bomb shelters, tragically, they're typically doing their job. Thank God for that there. But the air defense is letting too many missiles through, and some people tragically are dying, which again is why I want to get out. But it's no way to live, Jesse. It is simply no way to live your life there. Unfortunately, tragically, I think for a lot of Israelis, it's kind of just the mentality. They know this is the case. They deal with it there. But you know, as a non-Israeli and as an American there, it was pretty harrowing to deal with for a few days.
Okay, Josh. The mood of the people there when it comes to, like, I don't know if this whole thing's over. Frankly, I have my doubts because Iran hasn't changed their stance on things. Israel is perfectly aware that Iran, setting that aside, that I doubt the whole thing's over. What is the mood of the Israeli people with all this? Because this has been going on for quite some time now.
So Iran,
by the way, I should clarify, I'm talking the war itself. I'm talking about Gaza. I'm talking about Iran. I'm talking about all this stuff. Where are they at with all this? Are they sick of it? Are they all in? Where are they?
Right. So part of the whole debate, Jesse, for the past couple of weeks has been who started this? You know, what is the starting point of the war? I've heard some people say this is Israel's war of aggression in Iran. With respect, that's just not really accurate, right? I mean, at a bare minimum, the current war against Israel started on October 7, 2023. Hamas received lots of training and funding from Iran there. Hezbollah, Houthis, all the various Iranian tentacles have been trying to go after Israel. Indeed, they've been going after American ships and going after Americans themselves. I mean, the U.S. Marine barracks bombing in Beirut, Lebanon, killing 240-plus Marines back in the early 1980s came from an Iranian proxy, Hezbollah. So to me, the beginning of Iran's war against what they refer to as the little state of Israel and what they refer to as the big state of the United States, this war essentially starts when the regime is formed with the hostage crisis that ended the Jimmy Carter presidency back in 1979 there. So that really is how far back this goes. Now, having said that, with that context, and given the fact that this has been going on for so long, Iran's been chanting death to Israel, death to America for my entire life, essentially. It's definitely my entire adult life there. You know, Iran is not a particularly contested issue among the Israeli political spectrum. And I'll give you an example. So in 2016, I was there with a law school delegation, and we met with a very far-left member of the Israeli parliament. This guy was so far-left, total literal socialist. He was actually supporting, Jesse, I kid you not, Bernie Sanders in the primary back then in 2016. Even this guy, who was a Looney Tunes Marxist socialist, even this guy was actually very sober and hawkish on the Iranian issue. Iran is simply not a contested issue. Israelis know that Iran is an existential threat, at least a nuclear-armed Iran there. So this is a very, very popular operation that Netanyahu has done there on the home front. There's very little doubt about that, I think.
Okay, Josh, let's, I'm not switching gears here, but let's talk about the political, the environment in Israel, because they, it is a divided country, just like ours is. Netanyahu, the current government, is it unpopular? Is it popular? Is it, what are the reasons behind it?
Right. So even though Iran is not a particularly contested issue, Netanyahu himself is a deeply polarizing, divisive figure in Israel, the same way that Donald Trump is a deeply polarizing, divisive figure. They're actually shockingly similar, Jesse. If you look at the biographies of Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu, there are more similarities, frankly, than differences. They've both been prosecuted in unprecedented ahistorical lawfare. They're literally dragging Netanyahu into court, Jesse, during this war for alleged bribery charges. It's the exact same thing. The deep state, the prosecutors, the judges, they're all in there against him the exact same way that Jack Smith and the whole Democrat lawfare complex was against Donald Trump here. The similarities are, frankly, outright shocking. But this probably will boost Netanyahu's domestic political standing, if I had to guess, again, for the very simple reason that Iran has been the sword of Damocles hovering over the Israeli people for decades. And again, there are plenty of issues in Israel that are very hotly divided. The Palestinian issue is definitely an issue where Israelis are mixed minds, although increasingly they reject the so-called two-state solution after October 7th. The issue of the Haredim, the so-called ultra-Orthodox, entering the IDF, the military draft, that is a very hotly debated issue. There are plenty of issues over there that are hotly debated, but the Iranian issue is just really not one of them. Maybe the Arab Israelis are different, but the Jewish Israelis, I think, no matter whether you are right, center, left, whatever, understood that this regime cannot get a nuclear weapon because they say they want to commit a second Holocaust, and they've given no indication whatsoever that they will not do that if they get a nuclear weapon there. So I think it's a very popular operation in Israel. I think Netanyahu probably stands to benefit politically from it.
Josh, I'm glad you and yours are safe, my brother. Welcome back home. Take care. All right. It's a wild, wild world, right? Wild way to live. Say, always be 2 minutes from a bomb shelter. Anyway, we need to lighten the mood down. Next.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
I like J.D. Vance. It's time to lighten the mood, by the way. I like J.D. Vance. I greatly enjoy the dynamic between J.D. Vance and Trump. Trump very clearly likes J.D. Vance, gives him all kinds of leeway to speak in important meetings. And, well, I thought this little moment showed these two get along pretty well.
And the president looks over at me, puts the foreign leader on mute and says, "This is not going very well." And he presses the red button. And I, my eyes get really big, and I'm like, "Mr. President, you know, what just happened?" And he looks at me and he goes, "Nuclear. Nuclear. And 2 minutes later, a guy walks in with a Diet Coke, and he looks back at me and he says, "It wasn't nuclear, it's just the Diet Coke button." And that's... So that's the kind of guy, my fellow Republicans, that we have as the President of the United States.
That's a great story. All right. I'll see you.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations. Thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart Podcast.